yeah, we were just watching TV, and she just kind of walked in and was like, oh, sorry. And then walked out again, and I was like, fuck, she knows, you gotta leave. I kicked my girlfriend out, and my mum was like, so, is that your girlfriend? I was like, girlfriend? No, I'm not gay, what? No! Like, just completely, like, denying it. And then about 10 minutes later, she was like, you know what, if she is your girlfriend, that is okay. I was like, yeah, she's my girlfriend. And that was the conversation. That was just kind of the conversation. And she's been fine ever since.
Hello, my name is Kay Anderson, and you are listening to Lost Spaces, the podcast that mourns the death of queer nightlife. Every episode, I talk to a different person about a venue from their past, the memories they created there, and the people that they used to know. This week, we are meeting Sharifa Whitney James, a queer black activist, footballer, model, and facilitator. Originally from Wiltshire, England, Sharifa moved to Bristol to take a spot at a football academy when she was just a wee teenager around 15 years ago. And Bristol was the city where she first went out on the queer scene, visiting clubs like Flamingos, Vibes, and Bent. But those spaces didn't always feel quite right and weren't always the most welcoming. And that's where Kiki Bristol came in, a night co-founded by Sharifa and created for queer, transgender, and intersex people of colour and their friends. We caught up to discuss homophobia in football, having sex in a tent, no less, and drunken, straight male stag parties.
I started playing football when I was 8 years old. I was at primary school and I got quite severely bullied at primary school because I was the only black kid in my primary school. And football became a bit of a safe space for me. I played football with the boys and they would never question me about being a girl or being black. They just let me play football. So it kind of became the first, essentially safe space. And I got quite good. I think I was naturally quite good anyway. And then I kept playing and got better. And so I just kept playing football and I kind of played in different teams and moved to Bristol and played for Bristol Rovers and went to an academy and, you know, had some amazing opportunities to play against international teams and play for or have trials for England schoolgirls. So I played at quite a good level when I was young. But now I'm old and slow and I just play for fun, basically. So I just play grassroots football.
And this is the thing about sports that I find really like sad. I mean, sorry, just taking it into a sad direction. But like with, you know, if you want to be a painter or you want to be a writer or you want to be like a journalist, you can just kind of keep going throughout your life. But with sports, like if you want to be a professional sportist,
sporter,
then there's such a shelf life.
Oh, 100%.
It's just really sad. I didn't do it.
Yeah, for sure. Like all of the women that I played football with when I was young have just now started to retire and I'm like, oh my fucking God. Like I am getting old. I'm 33 and everyone I know who I played with and kind of went on to be professional is now starting to retire. Or they're seen as the elders of the community. And it's like, what the fuck? Like,
it's so mind-boggling, isn't it? It's just so weird.
It's scary how time flies. I feel like a child inside. And I always forget, like, I'm a big woman. Like, I always forget. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm, like, actually grown up. And life's moved on.
No, you're not. 33.
I mean, 33. No. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's young. It's young to a point, but... Yeah.
I mean, the only kind of silver lining I see in that is like that at least you know, you just kind of, you know, that like it's time to just stop. Oh, no, no, yeah. No, that's terrible. No,
well, it's not about stopping. It's more like, you know,
readjusting.
Of course, there's a shelf life. Yeah, there's a shelf life if you want to be a professional footballer, but you can still play grassroots football until you're like in your 70s. Like, I know a woman who played football until she's in her late 60s, 70s. So you can always keep playing as long as your body allows you to. You can always play the game, but obviously at a lesser level. So in a way, sport's good for that. You can keep playing for fun for a very long time.
And so when you were at the academy and playing football, was that just your entire life?
Yeah, it was my entire life for 3 years. It's funny because me and my friend, we reflect on academy days quite a lot because it was great in terms of footballing stuff and what we learned about our self-development in terms of football. But there's a group of three of us who got severely bullied and we were like 18, 19.
And a lot of little queer...
Yeah, we were, yeah, at the academy, yeah. And there's a lot of like closeted women in the team who were just bullies basically. And they would bully us about being gay or not being very good at football. But we were, but it's like around, basically it's a very toxic environment, football. And you think because it's women, it would be less toxic, but it's not because the women replicate men footballers who are also toxic. So it became a really unsafe space actually for the 3 years that we were there. And we often reflect on how horrible and nasty it was and no one ever did anything about it. Because I think in football culture, it's kind of accepted to be a bit mean or like, you know, to bully is like part of the banter in football.
Yeah, I was just having a laugh, yeah.
But actually, you're just being a dickhead. But when you're a bit older, it doesn't get classed as bullying in the same way as it might do if you were younger. So yeah, there's a lot of like pros and cons about that time. But I would say overall, it meant to be a fair overall. It was very mixed. It was a tough time. Tough time.
It's really interesting that you say there were lots of closeted lesbians because, again, with my very limited knowledge, I would just expect everyone to be a lesbian on a women's football team.
Yeah, and I think that's the kind of the illusion. Not illusion, I suppose, to a degree that is true. In women's football, there are a lot more out footballers. But when you're young and... That was, you know, we're talking about 15 years ago now, so it wasn't quite the same narrative around being queer, being LGBT as it is now. And people were coming from their little hometowns in Wales or from Wiltshire or from wherever and coming to big Bristol and playing semi-pro football. So everyone's quite sheltered and people aren't really out yet and they're discovering who they are. So I think a lot of discovery happened for a lot of those young women who were there. They came to the football team straight and then obviously... being in a team full of women who are, some are out, some are not, a lot of self-discovery happened. But before that happens, the homophobia happens because, you know, you have a lot of internalized homophobia often as queer people. And it just played out in really horrible ways, you know, it's wild. And a lot of racism as well, like really severely like racist. It was a mess time. It was really weird. Like when me and my friend talk about it, we're just like, that was wild. Like, I can't believe we survived that. And it was never picked up by anybody.
And it's a funny, like I'm projecting here, so forgive me if I'm incorrectly projecting. But I suppose when you're, like it's something that you've dreamed of, it's something that you really want to happen. So you kind of try to ignore some of those microaggressions or full out 100%. Aggressions in order not to rock the boat. And then they all just kind of start adding up, don't they?
100%. But also like I didn't have the... confidence, or I couldn't really articulate what was happening really. Like now I'm obviously older and wiser and I know that was definitely X, Y, and Z. But at the time, as a young person, you're just like, oh, this is a bit weird. You don't really know how to articulate what's happening to you. You know it's not good, but you're not quite sure what it actually really is. You know?
Yeah, and I guess there's also like, as you said, like 15 years ago, homophobia was more tolerated. And so if you have a problem with homophobia, then you are the problem.
Exactly. And like, it's funny because both of our coaches, we had two female coaches and they were both gay women. They become complicit in it because they don't do anything. Because their hands are tied because there's a lot of favouritism in football. So the best players or the favourite players are the ones being mean, can be absolute dicks. So... their hands are tied between, if they tie them off, they might leave the team and then they've lost two good players. So, do you know what I mean? And so it's a lot of politics, football politics, basically. Mm. It's heavy and complex and archaic.
It's just really shit, isn't it? Like, the people who just have the power can do... Hang on, this is British politics right now.
Yeah, exactly.
Do what they want.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So yeah, weird time.
So then were you able to have a nightlife and anything, or were you just like getting up at like 5 o'clock in the morning to train?
Yeah, so we trained pretty much every day in the week, and then obviously the weekend, well, Sundays were football days on the weekend, so we had kind of Friday night, Saturday to, you know, have our own time. And yeah, so me and my friend would go gay clubbing in Bristol. Back then it was Flamingos and Vibes and a bar called Bent. And that was our little like space that we'd go out and have a good time in.
And have a good time is in air quotes for anyone.
Air quotes, yeah.
So this was a friend from the academy.
Yeah.
And were you just always out, and or did you kind of like figure each other out? And
it's weird because I came out a few different times. So I came out when I was 14, but to a few friends at secondary school. Then I came out. Well, I got found out again at 19. But
who found you out?
My mom. My mom found. Yeah.
And like pulled it out of you.
Basically, yeah. She caught me. That's the story.
another person or
another person? Yeah, it's my first ever girlfriend. My mom just kind of walked in, and we weren't even doing anything like naughty. You know, we were very civilized, just lying in bed watching TV, hugging, and my mom just stormed into the room to give me my clothes in air quotes.
And what were you watching? The L Word.
That'd have been such a cooler story to say we're watching The L Word, but it's like really boring. Probably watching like fucking SpongeBob SquarePants or something. I don't know. Like, really, it's really shit. We're just watching TV and she just kind of walked in and was like, oh, sorry. And then walked out again. And I was like, fuck, she knows. You gotta leave. I kicked my girlfriend out. And my mum was like, so, is that your girlfriend? I was like, girlfriend? No, I'm not gay. What? No. Like, just completely, like, denying it. And then about 10 minutes later, she was like, you know what? If she is your girlfriend, that is okay. I was like, yeah, she's my girlfriend. And that was the conversation. That was just kind of the conversation. And we've been fine ever since. But when I went to college, for some reason, I kind of went in myself. I didn't want to, I didn't feel comfortable or safe, mostly, to disclose that I was gay, even though I didn't say or deny it, but I was just, wasn't out about it. It was crazy now because I'm such a massive queer, so I can't even imagine myself containing all of this queerness, but it happened. I was out to maybe one or two people, but not out generally. So this particular friend, yeah, we were both kind of out to each other, and we'd you know, when you're young and you're in a new city and you're kind of, you know that you're gay and you know there's a gay scene, it all seems so exciting. It's like a new shiny toy. Like, you want to go there all the time. You want to be around it. You want to just like immerse yourself in that scene. So
then the first like gay bar you went to was in Bristol.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first time you went out?
Don't remember the very first time, but I remember the first few times, and it was absolutely, and I mean absolutely terrifying. I was so scared. Like, honestly, I was sweating bullets. Like, I was so scared, like, so terrified.
Wow. So, and then the friend that you were going with, whose idea was it? Was it yours or hers?
Good question. It might have been hers. And I was always up for, you know, new adventures and going out. I was quite an open person, still am. So I think it probably would have been her. And I'd been like, yeah, let's go. Let's do it.
And she didn't give you Dutch courage.
No.
Why is it called Dutch courage?
I don't know. It's weird.
Are the Dutch brave?
Maybe. I don't know.
Anyway, so you were shitting yourself.
I was shitting myself, yeah. And I didn't really drink at that time. I mean, I'm not a drinker now. I've just never really drunk. But at the time, I remember having a few Alco Pops, as you did back then. Classic Alco Pops.
What colour?
blue. It was always blue because it's just like, that was the thing everyone drank, was just like having a blue tongue and just drinking blue alcohol pops all night. It's just the thing to do. But yeah, so I remember walking in. Actually, my first image that I can really remember was like walking in, I think it was walking into Vibes, which is like one of the biggest gay clubs in Bristol back then, and seeing lots of older women who were looking really hungry. You know that look people give you? They're like, it's like such a hungry look, like they want to rip your flesh off your bones right there and then. Because I was young.
Oh, happens to
and
me
I was,
all the time, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. Same. But like walking in and just this sense of like, fuck, I'm going to get ripped apart here. Because I was looking really meek and mild and I was really scared. I wasn't very confident. But everyone was walking around so confident. And I was like, how are they doing this? Where's this confidence coming from? I don't have this confidence they all seem to have. But yeah, it's my. I just remember the looks people were giving me. Like they were absolutely hungry. Like you know, fresh meat on the scene. She's young. She's naive. Oh, it was just like, it was terrifying.
Under my wing.
Yeah.
So did anyone talk to you, or were they just too busy ogling you?
I think people tried to kind of like do the whole flirty eye dance that you do when you go to gay places. Like, we're both gay. I kind of like you, but it's like all talking with from the eyes. So not like overtly saying anything, but like a lot of like flirty eye stuff, which lesbians love to do. But at the time, I didn't know what that was.
Okay,
I didn't get the language.
Give me a little bit of a tutorial. So I'm terrible. Yeah. I'm terrible at flirty eye stuff.
Okay.
What do I need to do?
I think it's a lot on the eyebrow and a lot about staring people down. Just like,
oh, that sounds intense.
It's really, mate, it is so intense. It's so intense. It's like really like keeping the eye contact and being quite smouldering and a bit overconfident.
Okay. Oh, but and there's some mouth action then as well. So it's like a bit of a pursing.
A little bit of a pursing, but it's more in the eyes.
Okay.
It's more of the keeping the contact with that person. And like not averting your gaze at all. Keep it, holding that gaze.
See, this is why I'm really terrible at flirting, because I always try and act aloof, like that's going to be like more alluring somehow. But people are like, oh, he's not interested.
That is like totally my label. Like I'm so aloof. I don't have any flirt vibes at all.
I freak out if someone wants to stare too much. I can't.
That's what happened. I freaked out.
We need to like come up with a new way of flirting and try and make it a thing.
I feel like it's evolved though. I feel like flirting has evolved since like,
well,
you know,
because
when was
people
that?
Do 2000... it through their phones now.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. Exactly. I feel like, yeah, flirting has evolved now. People seem to be more overt in their flirtatiousness. So they're more, a bit more direct maybe if they like you.
Oh, that's good. Oh,
I would say, yeah, generally compared to like, yeah, years ago, I think it has changed how people flirt. So yeah, that was my first kind of time going out on the scene was absolutely, and it was terrifying for months. It didn't get any easier. Like I would say for probably a year, it was terrifying.
And, I guess like you're not always able to explain why you're terrified about something, but do you know what the factors were that contributed to that feeling?
It's a really good question. I think fear of the unknown. I didn't know the etiquette. I didn't know what the rules were to being in a LGBT space. Everyone seemed to know the rules and I didn't know what the rules were. Unwritten rules, the politics of the space, how we move in the space, how we take up space. I didn't know any of that because I was so new to it. So I think I felt stupid. I felt like I shouldn't really be here. I didn't know what to do. Everyone seemed so like, you know, sorted out. I have no clue how to be in this space. So I felt like a bit of a fraud, I think, for a long time.
And had you been to like regular bars a lot at this stage?
No, because I grew up not drinking, and I grew up playing sport at quite a high level. So I was always really sporty and quite sensible. So I didn't really go out and get smashed, you know. That wasn't my vibe as a youngster. I was very like, had my vision on being a footballer. So I just didn't, yeah. So for me, that really was my first kind of intro into going out and drinking.
So there was the kind of regular layer of like figuring out how to be in a bar. And then there was the extra layer of how to be in a queer bar.
How to navigate a queer bar, yeah. It was daunting.
And was there women-only venues in Bristol at that time, or were they all mixed?
They were all mixed. there were some places that were maybe slightly more leaning towards women and slightly more leaning towards men, but they were still quite mixed. Actually, mm-hmm. I think there was actually one gay man bar or two, but all the other spaces were mixed, but maybe slightly leaning more towards women. So I would say Flamingos back in the day was maybe, again, it was very mixed, but often more lesbians were there. And Flamingos was better in a way than Vibes, because Vibes was like older scene gays, whereas Flamingo was like younger scene gays. So I kind of fitted in kind of a slightly more there as a younger crowd. But again, terrifying, because everyone's just taking drugs and just being wild. And I wasn't really a drinker. I didn't take drugs then. So it was, again, like really terrifying seeing everyone off their face on poppers and passing out from poppers and like passing out from being so drunk or causing drama and fighting. I was like, what is this world I've gotten into? It's like, it's wild.
So what was the best fight you witnessed?
It's always between gay boys. Like, gay boys had the best fights because they did not like hold back. They went in. And, you know, a lot of the time it was twinks that would have the best fights, because I think they had to almost prove themselves maybe in a fight.
Oh,
and they would
like
just go,
chihuahuas are really aggressive.
Yeah, like, one fight I remember. It started in the smoking area and then led out into the road, and cars were having to swerve around them because they were just going hell for leather, like not holding back at all.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Do you know what it was about?
Maybe one had a boyfriend and one was flirting with somebody else. That often was the case. They got as a couple.
Standard.
Someone was flirting or someone like looked at them and that was it. It was just like hell for leather. That's not okay, and chaos.
I mean, I'm not a drinker either, so maybe this is why I can't really figure this out. But like, I have too much shame to fight in front of people.
Yeah.
I can't imagine like having a brawl like that.
No. I wasn't really a drinker. I didn't do drugs, so I didn't have the license to like just, well, I was drunk, so I had a fight. I just would never fight like that in public. I would be mortified, absolutely mortified. But also, I'm not a drama queen. I would never cause drama publicly like that. I would feel really embarrassed if I ever caused that kind of drama where the whole club was watching.
Oh, yes.
Like the entire club came outside and was watching the fight. Just, it was like...
And the thing is, like, once you're over the shock of a fight, they're really, like, comedic to watch. Like, how uncoordinated the people involved in the fight are. You know, it's like a performance,
100%.
Really.
It's like live theatre on a Friday night, basically.
Proudly sponsored by Blue Alcopops. And so once you got into the swing of things and once you got used to it, were you doing like bar hopping, or was there like a standard Friday, a standard Saturday night?
I think as I got used to it, I started to realise that I hated the music. I'm not really a pop fan. I've never been a pop fan. I've always loved R&B, dancehall, garage, those kind of genres. And I was always confused why all the gay club played such like shit pop music. I'm like, we're all gay, yes, but we don't all like the same music, like play a variation. So I remember someone saying Birmingham is better for that. Birmingham has a better mix of like genres and they have more black queers up there. So it'd be a better night. And I was like, okay. So basically me and another friend of mine that I met through the scene, we love dancing, so we would drive up to Birmingham on a Friday evening, like 7 o'clock, get a cheap hotel, or sometimes we just drive up to Birmingham and go to Nightingales, and then drive back the same day, just to go to like an R&B night.
How long is that drive?
Hour and a half.
Oh wow, that's commitment.
We were desperate. We were absolutely desperate for any kind of like any sense of decent music. And we found it in Nightingales. Like, we loved it. We'd go regularly. Great nights there. Also, seeing other people of colour. Other queer people of colour was, like, such a rarity in Bristol. Like, it was me.
Oh, that's interesting.
And three other people. Yeah, like, that is probably the main reason why I started to leave the Bristol scene, because there's a lot of racism on the scene. A lot of overt racism, but it was just so normalised. No one ever called it out. And as me and three other black people.
And so just for people who don't know And I don't think I know. I mean, Bristol is a fairly mixed city and has quite a big Caribbean population, doesn't it?
That's the thing. I think Bristol has this illusion in some ways that it's very, very diverse and we're all mixing together and having a fantastic time. But Bristol is diverse, but it's very, very segregated in the city. So actually, you can live in... So Clifton, probably the most affluent part of Bristol. Mm-hmm. You can walk around Clifton for a whole day and not see a black person.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow.
You know, you might see the odd one, but you don't see black people in Clifton, really. So there's areas of Bristol you can go to and not see black people. Or you can go to a different part of Bristol and only see black people.
Mm.
So it's very separate. And when you're black and you're queer or black and LGBT, there's not many of us. There's not many of us. So like I said, there's three or four all together out of all of the scenes and all of the clubs, like maybe five maximum that I would see.
Oh, wow.
On a regular basis. Yeah. So it felt very isolating.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose when you are different in any way, you're either fetishized by people or disregarded by people.
Exactly. Let's say I had a friend, and this is like to give you an idea of how fucked it was, how racist people were, but they weren't even aware of it. I had a friend, in air quotes, who said to me, so this is like my first maybe 6 months of going out on the scene. I had a friend say to me, oh God, I'd never date a black girl. Oh, that's so weird. Oh no. Say that to my face. I'd never date a black girl. So for me, as a young person going on this scene, I just thought, that must be how everyone thinks. They would never date a black person. No, we were talking about dating, I think, and she just said that out of the blue in my presence to my face. Like,
that's so shit. And then again, is that one of those situations where it's like you're so shocked you don't really know how to respond in the moment?
Yeah, I was young and naive and just like, well, she's my friend, so, you know, it's not, she's not being racist. That's just her preference. Me being so naive and just not getting it. And just, I was just a bit thankful to have a friend who was like, you know, happy to go out with me and go clubbing, because people were so distant with me. And it's hard to say whether that was to do with race or something else. But yeah, the energy was not good in terms of being black and being LGBT back then. It wasn't good.
Oh, that's really shit. It's one of those really hard things. Like, obviously, I don't have any experience with racism. But there are times when I felt in my gut like that someone's being homophobic, but I can't, like, I have no evidence. It's just this kind of sense of like, there's something going on here.
Yeah.
And the way that you're conditioned, the way that we're all conditioned as part of society, is to repress that voice and to be like,
exactly.
No, oh, I must be wrong. I must be wrong.
Yeah.
And it's only really in the last few years when I've started to be like, oh, no, I don't think I'm wrong.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was a very basic gay back then. Like, I am an activist now and I'm really on my shit now. But back then I didn't, you know, I'd come from a small village, very sheltered. I didn't have a clue about the world and what was going on. So when people would say overt racist things to me, it didn't always clock immediately. Mm-hmm. But when I reflect back, there's so many occasions, so many, where I'm like, damn, that was racist. Damn, that was this. Damn, like, yeah. But at the time, I was just a little kid. Like, I was just a dumb bint. I had no clue at all. Like, literally.
Okay, so you're going to just have to break down some terms for me. Dumb bint.
Yeah.
What is that? Is that the same as a basic gay?
No. I think it's a Sharifa-ism. I say lots of random things that don't really make sense. A bint, I don't even know what a bint is. A bint is like, I don't even know. Someone who's a bit stupid, like a stupid bint. You know, stupid woman. Yeah.
Okay. And a basic gay is just someone who's like drinking alcohol pops and dancing.
That is a really good description. Effectively, yes. But there's like, I still call people basic gays now, because there's basic gays, like LGBT people who aren't queer, and then there's queer people. So I always put them in two categories, queer people and LGBT people.
Ah, interesting.
And LGBT people tend to be more basic.
And is it a Venn diagram, or are they two separate circles?
For me, they're two separate circles. They're very Separate. There's people I know who are like straight gays. Do you know what I mean by straight gays?
Well, like just trying to assimilate to a heteronormative society.
Yeah, they're very hetero, but even though they're gay, so I call those basic gays. It can be used as a slur, but also used to distinguish between LGBT people and queers.
I think it's just a slur.
Oh, okay, fair.
Oh, but super interesting.
Yeah.
So you would never refer to yourself as LGBT?
No. Ah. Not anymore. I used to. But, you know, we get older and we kind of, our politics change maybe, and my politics have changed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And my idea of myself has changed a lot as I got older. And I feel that queer better suits what I'm about and what I stand for and how I, you know, where I sit in the world.
And is it more about like your politics and your activism as opposed to, oh, I guess they're interlinked, but the way you perceive yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a combination of those things. I think it's about being intersectional within that. I kind of felt restricted if I refer to myself as lesbian, which I never do anyway, but you know, if I had to call myself a lesbian or a gay woman, it feels quite restricting and quite binary, whereas queer has a broader scope of what that actually means, because, you know, I'm attracted to different genders, so not necessarily just attracted to women. There's a whole array of people within that I would find attractive, but yeah, it kind of definitely falls into my politics and what I believe in and what I fight for, falls more in the line of being queer and not being conventional. I'm quite an unconventional person, like I'm polyamorous. And so that doesn't often happen if you're an LGBT. I mean, you know, obviously LGBT people can be polyamorous, but generally being poly and, you know, my activism more aligns with queerness than it does being LGBT.
It's interesting. It's so fascinating the way that word queer is just evolving.
Yeah.
Over the last decade, I suppose. And I just love hearing the way people relate to it.
Yeah.
So you're talking about racism on the scene.
Yeah.
Did you see things shift at all? Or have you seen things shift at all?
I have seen, yeah. I mean, at the time, no, things didn't really shift from my perspective. And so this is where kind of things get better in the story.
Let's not get better yet. Let's just...
Okay. Let's stay in the shit and then we'll get better.
Let's just exploit the
get
shit.
Get down and dirty. Yeah. Okay.
And so I guess there's kind of two ways you can respond to it, in that, like, you can try and assimilate and try and be like, oh, you just don't mind me, I'm just here, like, don't perceive me. Or you can kind of take up space. What was going on for you?
I assimilated 110%. Again, I didn't have the confidence or the knowledge or the... I didn't have it about me to be the change.
Mm-hmm.
I just went with the majority because it was easier and that's all I kind of knew at the time. So yeah, I definitely assimilated and I kept going out on that scene for 2 or 3 years because in some sense it was like, it was the only space I had in Bristol to go to be around other LGBT people. And I wanted to go out dancing, so I kind of had to go.
Yeah.
But when I was there, I didn't really enjoy it. But I just kind of went through the motions of being there.
And then, so were you like canoodling with women folk?
I really wish I was. I have such a shit story.
Oh.
I was such a little like quiet, not a nerd, but I think for me, I got in my head from that comment from my friend about how she didn't find black women attractive. And so for me, because most women on the scene were white, they were the only women to, you know, go out with, flirt with. I got in my head about I'm not attractive, so people won't fancy me. And then that comment kind of proved me right because people didn't flirt with me. No one ever asked me out. I didn't get any attention.
But wait, when we were talking about the first night and everyone just being like smoldering in your direction, was that just an anomaly?
That was like the first few months when it's like, oh, fresh meat. But even so, even people would, that's the thing, like people would look, but they wouldn't approach.
Okay. And you were too timid to approach as well.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. I didn't feel confident to be like, oh, how about it? That wasn't my style. So yeah, like I didn't get with anyone at all for the 3 years I was there.
Ever?
Yeah. Ever.
Ever.
Yeah. And I really wanted to. Yeah.
What's the
like
point
I
in
was
going
desperate
out?
To I know. Like all you know, I saw every one of my friends get with somebody and I never ever got with anyone. I know, right? What a sad sack, fucking hell.
So when did you like become a practicing queer woman?
So basically, I had to force the issue. So basically, I went to Brighton Pride in 2008. So that Brighton Pride was my first ever Pride. I said to myself, right, I need to fucking get laid. This is it now. Like I'm sick of going out, not meeting people. I need to get laid. So I went to Brighton Pride on a fucking mission, literally on the mission. I wasn't going to come home until I had got laid, basically. So I went with my friend and we camped in the massive field because back then you'd camp out and then, you know, you'd go to Pride. And we met some friends from Academy who were there with their partners and their friends. And we kind of joined forces. There's like a little gang of us all together at Brighton Pride. And in that group was my first girlfriend, basically. Turned out to be my first girlfriend. But yeah, there's a girl in that group and we did the thing. We got it on.
In a tent.
In a tent at Brighton Pride. That's like the best story I can give you.
And this was on the, there was only one night, right? This wasn't like a skanky third day of the festival.
Well, I was there for like 4 days camping. So I think it was maybe the first or second night. Maybe the first night of Pride.
Ah, well, how interesting, because I always find like whenever I'm like, right, I'm on a mission tonight, this it's going to happen. I give off desperate vibes and then no one's interested.
Really? I think I probably gave off desperate vibes as well, but she was just like, she was up for it.
Yeah, I'll throw you a bone. So, come on, let's go.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, and it's funny because I remember we had the lovemaking and then in the tent and then the next day, we woke up and got out of the tent and the entire campsite were clapping like, woo! Because obviously we had been quite loud and the entire campsite was like smiling and cheering. I remember being so mortified.
Well, I mean, yeah. Most people's first time's really clumsy and awful. You got applause.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, I suppose it's kind of flattering, but also like really embarrassing. Like, everyone heard every single thing. But, Yeah,
there's no advice I can really give there.
There's not. No.
And then, like, so did your experiences of going out change after you had a girlfriend?
Well, of course, because then what happens? You fucking shackle up, don't you? You shackle up. You don't see the light of day ever again. So
you discuss adopting a cat, yeah.
A cat, many kids, you know, getting a mortgage, you know, wedding, all that within about a day of knowing each other. So what happened? I moved to Bristol. I was living at home at the time. I moved to Bristol to live with her.
Wait.
How long
had you known each other?
So we left Brighton Pride. I remember getting the train back from Brighton.
She was like, hey, do you want to move in?
Yeah, basically. And because she lived in Bristol, I lived in Trowbridge. And I remember on the way back from Pride, kind of talking about it, but like,
what?
Yeah, this is quite slow for lesbians, to be fair. But yeah, kind of talking about it, but like kind of joking. But I took it seriously. I was like, I'm moving out now. I'm moving in. So I would say it happened probably within a couple of months.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then there's just no need to go out, right?
Exactly. I literally didn't see the light of day for months. I was just in the house. But it didn't last 2 seconds, obviously.
Wow.
So I moved in. I didn't really know her. I moved in. I moved out 2 weeks later. I moved back home.
Oh, no.
And that was the end of that. Bish, bash, boss.
2 weeks.
Yeah. So yeah, that was my first initiation into the lesbian world.
And then so after that, like once you'd, you know, got your groove and you'd figured out like how to come on strong, how to make funny noises in a tent, were you like off and running or?
I think ultimately what I've realised is that I'm not a flirty person. I'm not a flirty, like, sexy person. I'm just awkward me, awkward, aloof me. And that kind of seems to work. I don't know. Like, I'm just myself. I'm not trying to put on this, like, persona of being sexy and flirty and, like, I'm just not that.
Oh, but I think, but, like, are you good at being upfront with people? Like, oh, hey, by the way, no. I fancy you.
No.
Oh, okay.
No. I've only asked 2 girls out of my entire life. Most people ask me.
Oh, okay. You just wait for them.
I just wait. Yeah. I don't know. Like, I'm still quite shy. And I think people, because I'm quite a confident person now. I'm very confident and very self-assured now. But people are quite shocked that I'm like a little bit shy around that kind of stuff. I'm really awkward. Mm-hmm. If someone likes me and they're very overtly into me, I'm just like, ooh, what to do? I get really sweaty and a bit like, you know, I'm just not. I have no cool, basically. I'm not a cool queer. I'm like awkward and quite shy and stuff like that.
Do you do that thing, like just sometimes getting swept up in if someone likes you and you don't really like them, you're like, oh, yeah, I'll just go along with it.
I used to when I had no like confidence in myself. Yeah, like of course it's flattering. If someone likes you, you're not keen on. Like, I would say my first 4. Maybe my first 5 partners or lovers, that was the case. I was just kind of, you know, not very secure, didn't really know what I liked, and so I would just go along with it because they were kind of into me. So it took me to find my first love where I was like, oh, I like her. And thankfully, she did like me. But before that, I didn't have enough self-confidence to believe that I could actually find or have a type or go for someone I actually fancied. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a real journey with that. Real journey.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's fascinating when you're just like, I don't really understand what this person sees in me, but I'll just go with it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Anyway, so making a change in the scene.
That probably came many years later. Many, many years later. So from the point where I met my first love, I stopped going out. I didn't really go out on the scene, but in a sense, like it was a decision to like it wasn't my scene. It wasn't for me, and I just didn't go. I realized it wasn't representing me, and it wasn't a safe space for me. So I just stopped going. So I just used to hang out with all the football girls and just go to the pub. And there's quite a nice pub where I live, where it's quite inclusive, and we all just kind of go there and, you know, have a nice inclusive time.
And so you were going out to this pub. You were like, you've just stopped going out on the scene altogether.
Yeah.
When did you notice a change, or how did a change come about?
I think, yeah, so I was getting kind of sick of going out in Bristol and not seeing still. This is like almost 15 years on, 10 years on, still not seeing many or any black queer faces out. And not understanding why, what was going on. Like, you know, there's a lot of black people in the city and there's a lot of black queer people, but they're not kind of going out anywhere. Mm-hmm. So I voiced that concern to somebody else in the city. And then they told somebody else. And so basically a little group of about 6 of us came together and we're like, we need to create a space that's for us. That's a safe space for us. And that's when Kiki Bristol was born. So I'm one of the co-founders of Kiki Bristol. And yeah, like we all came together, like I said, because we were tired of a lack of space that kind of saw us or represented us. And so our first couple of nights, we were quite low key about where our location was because we wanted to make it a safe space for anyone to come to who was a black or brown person. And we didn't want any kind of, you know, homophobes coming in and kicking off or any of their family knowing where the venue was. So we didn't advertise the venue at all. We just said, get in touch if you want to come. So we kind of like carefully disclosed to different individuals where the location was. And we'd have just a really lovely, chilled evening. We'd have open mic. We'd have a little bit of food. We'd have some music. We'd have like some like deep conversations around what it's like to be black and queer in the city. And so that's kind of when things started to change slightly in Bristol. But we've been going for about 4 years now, so it's quite new still, really.
Mm-hmm. And this is going to, I guess, one of those dumb questions, because you don't probably don't have enough distance from it in order to answer this with enough perspective.
Mm.
How have you seen that change play out?
I think from what I've seen, since we've existed, so other queer producers are like, we need to get our shit together and be more inclusive, because there were queer spaces that felt more safe than LGBT spaces, but they were very white.
Mm-hmm.
And they could be quite problematic at times. And so I kind of feel like it's made other groups in the city maybe reflect on how they're not being inclusive,
mm-hmm.
and working on being more inviting to people of colour. So there's a night in Bristol called Thorny. Well, there was a night in Bristol called Thorny. And they'd either fundraise money or they had a pot of money to give people of colour a car ride home. You know, for safety reasons. For me, that was quite a big, like, oh wow, okay, they've actually thought about how to make it safe for people of color to come to the space. And that's kind of like the turning point. So people now are kind of trying to consider how to bring in POC people, mm-hmm. to their events,
mm-hmm.
And once they're there, you know, how to make them feel safe. So I feel like we've kind of in a way started a conversation in Bristol on the queer scene about how to be more inclusive, and it's given the people who were in Bristol who are black and queer, it's given them a space to go to and meet other black queer people. Because it's not, you know, if you don't see yourself, you don't know who else is out there. So when you can come to a safe space and meet other people and talk about what's going on, it's so liberating and freeing. You know, I've been here 13 years and I never had a space like this. So to hold an event, and, you know, we've had varied events. We've had music events. We've had events in art spaces and having dialogue around being black and queer. One of the last things we did was at a really posh art exhibition in Clifton. Clifton's like one of the nicest parts of Bristol. And we had an entire exhibition around being African and being queer. It was beautiful. And we held a big talk there about being black and queer, basically. And I think we had about 100 people come.
Ah, great.
And that was mixed, you know, mixed black and white, but it was, you know, I would say probably predominantly more black. So we had, you know, some really good talkers. We had a really rich and lively debate about being black and queer in general. And I think that's the first time that's happened in that kind of space in Bristol.
Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of taking over spaces now that we haven't seen ourselves before, which feels, again, really liberating and important, you know, important to do, especially around, you know, during this time. So I think, yeah, we're just kind of making people start conversations and making people feel uncomfortable. Like, we're just taking over spaces now, we don't care. We're here and you can't ignore us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that's not really been the forefront of Bristol before. So it feels quite game changery, you know?
Mm. Yeah, it's really fascinating. Like, so through doing this, I overuse the word fascinating, I'm sorry. Through doing this podcast, like, I talk to like lots of different people about queer venues and what makes a space safe. And so sometimes we're talking about like a venue that is only used as a queer space. And sometimes we talk about like nights or things that are held in, what do I call non-queer spaces? A non-queer space.
A non-queer space, yeah.
Like nights that are held in non-queer spaces.
Yeah.
But that become queer just because of the people that are running the show, the way that the rules that everyone's agreeing to in order to be there. And it's just really fascinating, those elements that can just shift a space, just shift the way that you perceive that space and the way you feel welcome in that space and the way you feel able to take up room in a space because of that unwritten contract that everyone has signed up to in order to come along. And there's something as well, just about meeting other people like you, having those conversations and being like, oh, it isn't just me who thinks this. And then having that confidence to go and be like, I'm going to have this conversation with someone who doesn't think this.
Absolutely. I think there's pros and cons in taking over spaces that aren't originally for us. So there's quite a few art places in Bristol who are trying to be more inclusive and have people like Kiki in there running our events. But the issue that we come up against is, you know, we might want to run an event in a space that hasn't often been for us, let's say. And so when we advertise we're going to be in a space, we get messages from people who are Black and queer saying, I don't feel comfortable going here. This is not a space I feel comfortable going to because they have not ever been a space for me. So we have to try and break down the idea of, like, if we keep saying that, although their feelings are obviously valid and I hear what they're saying, but if we keep saying that, we won't take over places to make them be ours. So that's like the barrier that we've had a few times when we've had events in certain spaces that haven't been for us normally. People don't feel confident or comfortable to go because they're so white and they're so old and crusty. People don't feel confident or safe to go.
So just so we're clear, white equals old and crusty, right?
Well, in the context of like spaces and who leads and runs those spaces, yeah, it's often not necessarily crusty, but it's often white men and often older white men who rule and dictate what's there and who's there. Mm.
It's hard to navigate that kind of feedback as well, isn't it? Because like for every one person who shares that feedback with you, there are maybe 10 people who don't feel like they're able to. So it's like, how do you navigate that? And
I think it's really important to listen to the people that we're trying to serve. You know, it might not be pleasant to hear those things because, you know, we've had we've had some negative feedback about what we do. And when it's people from our community, so when it's Black people from our community, we absolutely listen, we take it on board. You know, we can't be perfect and we can't serve everyone, but we must definitely listen to make real change. So, you know, we've had comments about our spaces being too white. And this is the thing, right, with Bristol, because, you know, we're like one of the first LGBT POC spaces in Bristol, everyone's like, oh my God, this is really cool. And everyone wants to go, but everyone is mostly white people. So our events can sometimes be taken over by white people being really intrigued. And I wanted to support Kiki. They want to support us and be there. Do you know what I mean? So, but sometimes it's more white people than Black people. And we've had comments around that. People don't feel safe to go because often too many white people. I mean, you know, that was hard to hear, but you've got to listen. You can't be arrogant, but like, this is my event and it is what it is. Like, you have to listen. And so, you know, we had an event where it's just for Black people, Black and brown people. Yeah, it is hard. But if you're a good producer and if you're a good community worker, if you're really about serving the community, you've got to listen to the hard feedback. You can't be arrogant and you can't be so small-minded to like ignore some of the negative comments. And people do, you know, I know people in the city who don't listen to comments, and, you know, it's a shame because everyone's points are valid, whether you believe it or not. Everyone's points and everyone's view is valid as their perspective. So
yeah, and I guess like a lot of it comes down to what your drivers are for doing the night. And so in lots of instances, queer spaces, gay spaces, lesbian spaces have popped up with the background motivation not being I'm going to make a ton of money off these people, but being like I'm going to create a space where people feel safe and that they're able to come. And so that's why those spaces like become so special and so loved, because they're not driven by commercial means. Obviously that's an element of it, and you know, everyone's got to pay their rent, but when you're doing something from a place of love or from a place of community or driving change, then there are different things that you need to be paying attention to.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, like we all came up with this idea because we had a real passion, a genuine passion to try and create a safe space in a city that is very white. And so, you know, I think because we came from such a place of genuineness and we're marginalized twice over, I think we're just more open to being critical or having critical feedback, you know. If your drivers are more around making money, then of course you it's easy for you to ignore the negative feedback because you just want to get people through the door to make money. But for us, it's all about community, and you know, that is the heart of what we do. We want to try and serve and support our community.
And also not playing basic pop music.
I mean, that is the key. I mean, yeah, we had a such a sick night. We had an amazing night last year where we had a collaboration between this amazing DJ collective called Booty Bass, and they play like booty shaking music, you know, like dancehall, R&B, like, yeah, UKG, all the stuff that I love. So we did a Kiki Booty Bass collaboration, and oof, we rocked the house down. I tell you, it was so
good. They're still talking about it.
Yeah, no, literally people are though. People are because, you know, although yes, the music was fantastic, what I love about Kiki is that we really go out of our way to make everyone feel safe. So we're quite particular about who we let in. If we feel that you're going to come in and not get our vibe, then we're not going to allow you to potentially harm the space. So
how do you have
people on the door.
How do you manage that?
Yeah, it can be hard, but I'm a pretty good judge of character. So I was on the door that night. I've got quite a funny story about that. So I was on the door that night, and there was five white straight guys who were absolutely pissed, right? And they came stumbling over. They're like, oh, what's going on here then? What's this? And I explained what we were. I was like, we're Kiki and we do this. And they're like, oh, okay. Right, can we come in? And in that moment, I had to go with my gut, right? I had to think, are they going to be dicks and come in and cause havoc? Are they going to come in and be respectful? And in my gut, I felt they were going to be respectful. I let them in. And I tell you what, we had a fantastic night together. We were dancing. We were talking about what it's like to be black and queer. Because they were on a stag do. They were four white straight guys from Devon, right? Had never even seen black queer people before. And they were asking questions, but in a very respectable way. And they were like, this is the best night I've ever been to. This is so good. You're all great. And they were so lovely. I can't tell you how lovely and nice and respectful they were. They just stayed in the corner. They danced. They bought drinks. They overpaid so we could have more money. Like, they were just so lovely. So I think you have to judge it. And it's not always easy. But in that moment, I think I went with my gut. And they were so sound. And they were so thankful.
Who goes on a stag do to Bristol? Does that happen?
Yeah, they're four lads from Devon, so Bristol's quite big to them,
okay,
isn't it?
Sorry, that shouldn't be my takeaway from the story. It's like, wait, why aren't you in Prague?
But yeah, it can be hard to judge. We've had other times where we've had dickheads come in, you know, coked up white guys from Clifton who just stumbled on in another week. So we were running an event in Clifton, one of our first events actually, where it was like invitation only, effectively, and we had it on the door, do not come in. And these three coked up white guys came in acting, being really rude to everyone, really rude. I'm going to kick them out. So yeah, we try and have security on the door, or we have someone on the door who's going to be judging who's coming in. And you know, we walk around and make sure everyone's having a good time, and people can report people who are being assholes on the dance floor. So we try and keep it as safe as humanly possible once you're in that space.
It's a tough, I haven't done it, so this is just like from, you know, me imagining rather than me doing it myself. But it just feels like it's a really tough kind of balance to strike in terms of like letting people have fun, but also making sure that no one's disrupting.
Yeah, it is. It's a very fine line to cross, but I think we do it very well. I think we're very loving and compassionate and thoughtful and self-aware people. That we let people have a good time, but at the same time, if people are going too far, we're kind of just, we'll keep an eye on it, you know? We're not going to necessarily stumble over straight away, but we'll just kind of keep an eye on things and keep an eye on the space. And fortunately, the people that come to Kiki are just lovely people. We don't get assholes that come to Kiki. And honestly, it was such a beautiful moment of seeing, you know, white straight guys and black queer people just dancing in the same space and having a bloody good time. I will always cherish that night and that moment. It was so gorgeous, so gorgeous. And we want more of that. We want more of that.
If you enjoyed this episode or want to suggest a venue to feature on a future episode, then reach out and let's have a chat. You can find me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter with the username KAndersonMusic. And whilst you're there, make sure to follow Sharifa on Instagram. Her profile is gold_fro. Lost Spaces is not only a podcast, but a concept record as well. I have been writing songs about queer venues and the people who used to live their lives there, and will be releasing songs over the coming year. You can hear the first single, Well Grown Boys, which is also playing underneath my talking right now on all streaming platforms. If you liked this episode, I would really appreciate if you subscribed, left a review on your podcast platform of choice, or just told people who you think might be interested in giving it a little listen too. I am Kay Anderson, and you have been listening to Lost Spaces.